Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 65 years ago today, U.S. soldiers entered yet another Nazi concentration camp. April 21st, 1945. It was Hersbruck, just one of many throughout that month. Names that would become infamous: Dachau, Bergen-Belsen, Buchenwald. Edward R. Murrow of CBS News reported the horrors to the world.
In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only six. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. B-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die.
Today we speak with journalist Michael Hirsch about these events, and we speak with some of the liberators themselves. This hour On Point, remembering America's witnesses to the Holocaust. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in these stories of liberation and witnessing? Do you have a connection to these events? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll hear later this hour from U.S. veterans who entered the concentration camps. But joining me first from WGCU in Fort Myers, Florida, is Michael Hirsch, longtime journalist and writer on military affairs. His new book is The Liberators, America's Witnesses to the Holocaust. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mike, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, this is such an important work, an important book, and I wish you'd start by telling us who you interviewed as you compiled it.
I tracked down and ultimately interviewed more than 150 veterans, most of them men, about a half dozen women were nurses. Tracking them down was a huge project, as you could imagine. Many, many World War II veterans are gone. Without the internet, there's no way that I could have done this book. I found veterans through the veteran associations of their divisions, and then one person would lead me to another and lead me to another. To give you an example of the range of people I found, there was Melvin Waters from Texas, who actually wasn't an Army veteran. He was 4F because of high blood pressure, but he wanted to serve in the war for the Americans. So he joined American Field Services, an organization that provided the drivers, volunteers, for ambulances all over the European theater. They had done this in World War I. Waters ultimately got to Bergen-Belsen. There were 60,000 prisoners in that camp at liberation. 13,000 of them died after liberation from typhus and other diseases. Bergen-Belsen has, if you look on the web, you can find the newsreel footage of them using bulldozers to try and clear the corpses.
I'm curious, Melvin Waters and the other veterans that you spoke with after you tracked them down, what was their reaction to you reaching out to them?
It varied. I was surprised at how many of them had either only recently begun talking about their experiences in the war or had never talked about them. There were at least a half a dozen men that I interviewed who told me they had never even told their wives or their families about what they saw in the war. Their wives were hearing about it for the first time, listening to me interview the husband. As I said, without the internet, this book couldn't happen because there'd be no way to track these people down.
On April 4th, 1945, American soldiers entered the first concentration camp, wholly by accident. Tell us what happened.
They were looking for a German underground communications bunker that was supposed to have been built so Hitler would have a place to go and remain in command if Berlin fell, or when Berlin fell. They came into this camp called Ohrdruf, and that's the first place that American soldiers confronted what the Nazis had done. That's the first place they saw bodies stacked like cordwood, which is a phrase that came up repeatedly. Probably a third to half the interviewees I talked with talked about this memory in their minds of bodies stacked like cordwood. And Ohrdruf, which was a small camp, a sub-camp of Buchenwald, on April 4th was the first place They saw that. There was a 19-year-old GI there named Don Timmer from Mansfield, Ohio, who got pressed into using his high school German and becoming Ike's interpreter. General Eisenhower came to the camp, and the plane that his interpreter was on hadn't made it. So Don Timmer went through the camp with Eisenhower, Bradley, and Patton. And one of the things that struck me about what Timmer said was that he watched Eisenhower standing there just looking. And the other generals began to urge him to leave. Literally, the quote was, "Ike, we've got a war to fight." And Timmer recalls Eisenhower saying, "Don't bother me. I've got to get this." Mm-hmm. And as a result of getting it, Eisenhower issued an order that every GI in the European theater who could needs to see Ohrdruf and eventually the other camps. Mm.
Continue to give us an idea of what these young Americans faced. Read, if you would, one account from the book. It's from Private Leo Sarian. He tells what he discovered at the Hertzberg camp. He's with the 65th Infantry Division, right?
Hertzberg was liberated 65 years ago this date.
Right.
And Leo was a 19-year-old kid from Dallas, Texas. They were infantry. They were walking on foot. And he said that as they were walking down the road, several hundred feet in front of them, two large gates opened wide. And he says, two German trucks pulled out, and a handful of Germans jumped in and fled. It was toward the end of the war. Many thousands of Germans were either fleeing or surrendering. This handful decided to flee rather than confront us because we were a couple hundred men. We were on foot, and they were in trucks. We couldn't go after them. They disappeared before we could raise our rifles. And then slowly, we approached those open gates. We walked in, and the sight before our eyes caused us to freeze, like we were almost in a coma. To our left, on the ground, were dozens of bodies, like twigs that fell off from a tree, and most of them were dead. Some came crawling towards us. 19-year-old Private Sarian and his buddies had known virtually nothing about concentration camps, but without warning, they'd walked into one. He goes on, there was a pyre of human bodies, maybe about 8 feet high. They all appeared to be dead, but there could have been some alive on the verge of death. They didn't have any furnaces there to burn bodies, so I'm assuming they were going to just throw gasoline on them. Some came walking towards us haltingly, and some came crawling on their hands and knees. You could almost see their bones protruding out of their bodies and wondered how they still remained alive. Some of them were completely nude. When they approached us, we didn't know what to say to them. Some of them spoke, but we didn't understand. Some embraced us and clung to us, standing and on their knees. That's Leo Sarian recalling what he saw 65 years ago at Hertzberg.
The term liberator that you use, that is the title of your book, is problematic for you, and I know for many of the veterans you interviewed in the course of this work. How so?
It's problematic because it's the term of art that's used, which is why, even though I have a problem using the term, it's the title of the book, The Liberators. In most cases, nearly all cases, when the SS guards at these camps knew the Americans were coming, they fled. Sometimes 3 days before the Americans got there, sometimes literally minutes before the Americans got there. So the GIs generally didn't have to shoot their way into the camps. They walked in. Their orders were usually to contain the prisoners, the former prisoners, in the camp. And suddenly they were confronted with things they didn't even know about, but they had to take care of them. So a lot of these guys just don't like being called liberators. They prefer being called witnesses to the Holocaust because that's really what they were. My personal view is, if you're going to call guys who just walked into the camps or drove past the camps liberators, then you really have to call every American, every Allied soldier who liberated the continent of Europe a liberator, and that includes the guys who died in the surf at Omaha Beach. I just have a problem keeping that term applicable only to the guys who went into the camps.
You'd think that 65 years after the fact, that the memories of this might be fuzzy in an 80, 85-year-old veteran. Were they? Did you find the details accurate? Were they able to be corroborated?
In most cases, they were able to be corroborated by other guys who were in the same unit, sometimes by documents they found online. But there's certain memories, although 65 years old, are absolutely clear in their minds as though they'd happened yesterday. I mentioned the phrase body stacked like cordwood. That's a phrase that kept coming up. That's something that's burned into their retinas. They can see that. The other thing that they haven't been able to forget is the stench, the smell. They all remember what it smelled like. Olfactory memory, I guess, is one of the strongest memories we have. But it was, once I could get them talking, they remembered many things. There are certain things when you're doing oral history like this that they may not be accurate on. Dates, sometimes even places. There were a lot of guys I talked to who knew they had been to various camps and didn't know what camp it was. They had no names for it. But the memories are there.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour about the GIs who liberated the Nazi concentration camp 65 years ago this month. Joining me today is Michael Hirsch, author of The Liberators, America's Witnesses to the Holocaust. Last week in an event in Washington, D.C. to commemorate the 65th anniversary of the liberation of the concentration camps, CENTCOM Commander General David Petraeus spoke before 120 U.S. military veterans who were there.
As we commemorate the liberation of the camps, it is important that we not only remember the mission carried out by the men and women we honor today, it is also important that we remember the way in which they performed that mission. The sincere compassion, genuine kindness, and abiding concern they demonstrated for those they rescued were as admirable as the courage they demonstrated throughout the liberation of what had been described as Fortress Europe.
General David Petraeus there. I want to introduce our other guests this hour, but before I do so, here's a little more from the famous report by Edward R. Murrow of CBS News, reporting from Buchenwald, Germany.
Permit me to tell you what you would have seen and heard had you been with me on Thursday. It will not be pleasant listening. If you're at lunch, or if you have no appetite to hear what Germans have done, now is a good time to switch off the radio. For I propose to tell you of Buchenwald. It is on a small hill about 4 miles outside Weimar. And it was one of the largest concentration camps in Germany. And it was built to last.
That famous report from 1945. I'd like now to introduce someone who was there at Buchenwald in those first days. Joining me from Swansea, Massachusetts, is Milton Silva. He was a sergeant with the Army's 120th Evacuation Hospital. He arrived at the Nazis' Buchenwald concentration camp on April 14th. 1945, as U.S. troops liberated the complex and began helping survivors. He later spent a career as a judge in Massachusetts. Mr. Silva, so nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Well, you grew up in Fall River, Massachusetts, and as I read your story, you were 19 when you were drafted. You were part of the 120th Evacuation Hospital, as I mentioned. How was it that you came upon that concentration camp, Buchenwald?
Well, we had been in Frankfurt after chasing General Patton across the continent, and we got the word that we had to move out, and we weren't told where we were going. And everybody had some rumors that there was a big offensive, and there were a lot of casualties. So we loaded up and drove most of the day and throughout the night, and as we approached our destination, which was still unknown, Hibby James, who was riding with me, said, "Milt, there's something smells around here." And I said, "Hibby, there's somebody dead around here." because I grew up in the funeral business. I'm a third-generation funeral director in addition to having studied law and being a judge. And my family still operates a funeral business. So that the smell of death was not unknown to me. And as we approached our destination, the stench just got stronger and stronger. Initially, I thought it was just one or two bodies laying alongside the road that had decomposed, but the extent of it was just overwhelming when we opened the gates or walked into the gates at Buchenwald. All my years in the funeral business just never really prepared me for the sights and the sounds and the scene that we encountered as we went into the camp. One of the things that bothered me after I got over the initial shock was what appeared to be a complete lack of respect for the dead. Having grown up in the funeral business with a father who insisted that you treated everybody with respect, you never told jokes, you never laughed, you never made comments. The bodies were to be draped at all times, and once they were casketed and dressed and casketed, the sheet that you used sent to the laundry. At Buchenwald, they didn't bury the dead. They did at Nordhausen during the short period that I was there, and as well as Mauthausen, the dead were buried. But Buchenwald was left for people to come in and see what actually had happened. And in retrospect, I guess that was the right thing to do at the time, but I still found it very distressing.
At one point during that day, you saw a Nazi guard being beaten.
Yes.
I wonder if you'd tell us that story.
Well, I was with Stanley Pinkowski from Detroit, and we heard all of this noise going on, and we went over. I couldn't really see much because the person was surrounded by most of the inmates, and they were yelling in a strange language, which Pinkowski could understand. And he told me that this man was being beaten by the that he was a god, and he was being beaten. And I just didn't want any part of it and left it.
And I know as horrendous as the events that you were witnessing before you at the camp, you turned and walked away, and you write, or you tell Michael Hirsch in his book that was indeed a moment of shame for you, despite what had happened and what they had done.
It was a moment of shame because I got caught up in the frenzy. And, I mean, that poor man was responsible for my being where I didn't want to be. And I just started to yell, "Kill the SOB," and I just felt very shameful about that. And I wish that there was something I could point to with pride that I had done at the camp, and I can't.
But you got there.
I got
that's
there.
That's something to point with pride to. All the GIs who got there and did it.
We hear so much about your generation, Milton Silva, and the extraordinary things that you did, how you served, you came home, you didn't talk much about what you witnessed, as horrific as it was, about your heroism. Did you ever talk to anybody about those things that you saw?
No, in fact, I didn't really talk about my experiences until maybe my third or fourth year as a judge. There was a Judge Quinn who ran the juvenile court, and he got caught up in teaching students about the Holocaust. And he knew that I had been at Buchenwald and finally prevailed upon me to talk about it. And reluctantly I did, and from then on I kept getting calls from students, from teachers, and various other educational places, at Bristol Community College, the various synagogues in the area, And initially it was rather difficult, but as we got along, it became easier. And in fact, just last Monday before I went to Washington, I spoke to the West Bridgewater High School group of about 150 students.
And what do you want them to know about those concentration camps, about what you saw?
I just want them to know that it happened. And in fact, I exact a pledge from the kids at the end of my talk that 20 years from now, if somebody says that the Holocaust never happened, it was just a lot of propaganda, I want them to stand up and say, hey, I heard a judge talk in 2010, and he was a witness, and I believe what he said.
Michael Hirsch, your response to Milton Silva.
Milton is an incredible person to speak with. He told me in the book about his experience going into the crematorium building and going downstairs in the room below the ovens, where they had meat hooks hanging on the wall, and they would garrot prisoners and then hang them up until it was time to cremate them. Milton was interviewed for a newspaper article, and he mentioned that story. And just so you know what's out there, somebody posted afterwards saying, well, you know, you say those meat hooks were for killing people. How do you know that the Germans weren't just butchering cattle and hanging them up there? And it's Milton being able to talk and other veterans being able to talk that puts the lie to people who would, even to this day, even in response to him and to my book, would say those things never happened.
Well, the fallacy is that if it was a side of beef, how could they dig their fingernails into the walls at a certain height from the floor? And how would they be able to kick with their toes at the bottom and create indentations into the wall? I don't think cattle is able to do that.
I'd like to invite some listeners into this conversation to Westwood, Massachusetts. Rob is on the line. Rob, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I guess, for both your guests. I am 66. I was a year old when this went on. Did no one in this country or in the Army or in the intelligence or in the Roosevelt administration know that this was going on? And how was this possible?
The short answer is, yes, they knew it was going on. There still is a continuing controversy over the refusal to bomb the tracks into Auschwitz, which was one of the main killing camps in Poland. But people knew it was going on. The interesting thing for me was that most of the GIs who were fighting in Europe didn't know it was going on. I know because I've read some intelligence documents that the Allies knew where the camps were, but that information didn't get passed down to the grunt or the guy riding a tank. And that's why confronting these sites for the first time was such a shock. Early on when I was doing the research, I had asked guys if they knew about it in advance, were they prepared for it? And one man said to me, how would you prepare to see that?
Here's Sava calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Sava, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Just by accident, I was listening to the radio in the shop, and I heard about the conversation. And I'm making this call just in the memory of my parents. I come from Croatia, and my mother and father and almost all my relatives were in the concentration camp in Jasenovac. Most of them died. Just my mother and father, and my uncle survived. And when people talk about this, I just want them to understand that there were other nations there, Serbs and Russians, who were in concentration camp as much as people, the Jewish nation. So that's the only thing I want to say.
Sava, thank you very much for your call. Michael Hirsch, Sava reminds us that there were 1.3 million Serbs that died millions of Jews as well.
There were at least 5 million non-Jews that the Nazis killed, many of them in camps. They were an equal opportunity destroyer.
Milton Silva, I'm curious if you could articulate the profound impact of you as a young, tough American soldier. How were you affected at that time by what you saw, and how are you affected today?
Well, as I indicated, I was upset over the fact that the bodies weren't being buried, but it was just a sight that was unbelievable, that anyone could treat other human beings this way. I had occasion to listen to Susan Eisenhower while I was in Washington, and she talked about her grandfather when he got to the concentration camps and they wanted him to leave, and he was reluctant to do so. And Susan said that what bothered him the most was the fact that, being of German ancestry, both his mother and father were German, that people of his nationality could treat other human beings this way. And it had a profound effect on him, according to Susan. And it affected everybody who had occasion to see that. In fact, it got to a point where I had to change my career. I started out being a trade embalmer when I got out of the service, because that's what my family did. But I got to a point where if I walked into a morgue and got the stench of death, I wanted to turn around and leave. And you can't be an embalmer if you can't stand the smell. So.
Michael Hirsch?
Jane, one of the points that I think people need to remember is that we were sending kids to war. These were people who were 18, 19, 20 years old.
That's right.
If you can imagine yourself at that age, or a son or a daughter, walking out and seeing two people killed in a car accident and the impact that would have on them. Now take an 18 or 19-year-old kid, and with no warning, he walks into a camp. He walks through a barbed wire gate, and there in front of him are stacks of bodies, sometimes a pyre where bodies were partially burned, but otherwise literally bodies stacked like cordwood. And you have to imagine the impression that makes on a 19-year-old kid. That's in there forever. That doesn't go away. And what I discovered in talking to some people as old as 96 years old is that many of them are still having flashbacks. Many of them are still having night sweats. They're exhibiting the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, just like veterans of Vietnam and just like veterans of our current war. And this is 65 years after the fact. War doesn't go away just because you sign a piece of paper.
Milton Silva, thank you, sir, for speaking with us today and for your service those many years ago.
Well, thank you.
Milton Silva is a sergeant with the Army's 120th Evacuation Hospital. He arrived at Nazi's Buchenwald concentration camp April 14th, 1945. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour about the GIs who liberated the Nazi concentration camps on the 65th anniversary of those events. Last June, President Barack Obama visited the Nazi Buchenwald concentration camp in Germany. He toured the camp, and then he spoke about Buchenwald's meaning in our history.
To this day, there are those who insist that the Holocaust never happened. A denial of fact and truth that is baseless and ignorant and hateful. This place is the ultimate rebuke to such thoughts, a reminder of our duty to confront those who would tell lies about our history.
I am joined today by Michael Hirsch, author of The Liberators, America's Witnesses to the Holocaust. And joining me now from Old Westboro, New York, is Stanley Friedenberg. He was an officer in the Army's Counterintelligence Corps. He arrived at the Nazis' Ohrdruf concentration camp on April 5, 1945, in the hours after U.S. troops first entered the complex. Part of the Buchenwald system of subcamps, Ohrdruf was the first concentration camp to be liberated by American soldiers. Later, Mr. Friedenberg was also at the concentration camp at Gusen-Mauthausen in Austria on May 5th. Mr. Friedenberg, thank you for being with us today, sir.
Glad to be here.
As I mentioned, you were an intelligence officer, and in a unique position. You had no rank on your uniform when you entered those camps. What exactly was your duty there?
Well, we were generally doing counter-espionage work, but we would switch to war crimes work as the necessity arose to try and track down the people who were responsible for the atrocities.
And did you or your fellow soldiers, did you know anything about the concentration camps?
Not a thing. It was a complete surprise to us.
And so how did you come upon it?
We received a radio call that there was a concentration camp with many dead bodies just somewhat north of us. And we went there, drove through the gates, and the sight was just appalling. In front of us was a pit with hundreds of bodies, nude. It was a little more than skeletons. And somebody had started to pour lime over the bodies at one end, but the job was not finished. As many soldiers have told you, the thing that remains with us for the longest is the stench that arose from all of this.
And what did you do? What do you do in a moment such as that?
You recoil from it, and it just shakes you shakes your beliefs to its roots that people could do something like this who were in no position to take any action at that point. We were not in charge of the situation. There was nothing we could do, and the Red Cross was coming into the situation to help out. But it was just an unbelievable sight that one human being can do this to another.
How long were you there, sir, and did you think that there were more concentration camps?
When we saw that, we assumed that we were going to find many, many more. But we stayed at Ohrdruf for about 2 or 3 hours. Then we had to move on.
You were unique.
I took one picture, mm-hmm. Which I still have, but then I could not take any more. It was just too awful.
I'm curious where you keep that picture and if you look at it today.
Yes. Most of those people killed there were Polish. They had been workers in the various factories around there and had died of malnutrition, abuse, or whatever, and then were being disposed of before the American troops arrived.
You were unique, sir, in that you saw the liberation of this first German camp, Ohrdruf, and then you were a month later at Gusen-Mauthausen concentration
yes.
camp. Could you compare the two?
Well, Mauthausen was an enormous place spread out over a large territory and much more organized let's just say a better killing place. They had their crematoriums well organized, and people there just died from abuse, overwork, starvation, exposure to cold. Whoever didn't die that way, they would exterminate either there or at Hartheim Crematorium. And my first view coming there was of the skeleton-like people clinging to the barbed wire, none of them weighing 100 pounds, with big hollow eyes, and saying nothing, just staring at us. Hmm. We had the people there wanted, the 11th Armored, wanted to open the gates and free them, which would have been a terrible thing because they would have roamed over the countryside intermingling with German people, and we didn't know what would happen. So we ordered the gates closed, and fortunately our orders were followed, and then radioed for help. And by the end of the day, medical help was arriving to try and save what they could. The place was so horrible that every morning they used to go through these large, multi-tiered barracks to clean out the dead people. Again, the smell is the one thing that stays with you forever.
Michael Hirsch, as you interviewed Stanley Friedenberg, what do you remember most vividly beyond what he's just told us of his story?
I remember him talking about the image of the people hanging on the barbed wire and how, Stan, wasn't it you that told me that you saw that image in a large photo?
Yes, in Yad Vashem.
In Jerusalem.
There in the exhibit, and they had photo murals, and the last one was a large picture, exactly what I saw when I approached the fence, looking at the same view that I had. It stirred me so much that I just sat down on a bench and cried. And I don't cry very often.
Stan, I wonder if you could tell Jane and the listeners how the experience of seeing the concentration camps affected your belief in God.
Well, it did shake my religious beliefs, and they're somewhat recovered, but not fully. I could never understand how a supreme being could allow this to happen to any of his people. And theologians and many religious people have given me lots of rationalizations about it, but it just doesn't add up. Just how something like this could be allowed to happen.
Did you find that often, Michael Hirsch, in your interviews with the GIs?
I found a significant number of the soldiers who were at those camps lost their faith in God, but by sheer coincidence, perhaps an equal number found it to the extent that they became clergy. One of those people was a man named Forrest Robinson, who had gone to Nordhausen and saw just death upon death upon death. And he came out, let me just read what happened to him briefly. He had been inside this building where there were bodies stacked like cordwood and living people among them too, who had no strength to move. And he says he came out, grabbed the Jeep, he vomited. And then he says, utterly overwhelmed by this crushing mixture of circumstances, I literally lost it. I raised my head to the heavens and cursed God in the vilest of language. I screamed there could not be a God who could allow such a thing as the Holocaust, and dismissed civilization as but a thin skin covering a basic savage. Suddenly, in total and spiritual and physical exhaustion, he said he fell over the side of the Jeep and vomited. And he ultimately became a clergyman. And he told me in writing, because he has a profound hearing loss, and so the interview was conducted in writing, he said he has no memory at all of the 2 weeks following that experience at Nordhausen. He says his mind for that period went completely blank.
Here's another listener who will join our conversation now from New River George, West Virginia. Ben is on the line. Thank you for waiting, Ben. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. My ancestors are Jews from Czechoslovakia that escaped the Holocaust and came to America, and I'm incredibly moved, obviously, by the stories that you've collected and the stories that I've heard the liberators talk about today. I was curious to know what kind of conclusions you've drawn in your research and also what conclusions the liberators have drawn about genocide as it continues around the world. The feelings, the strongest feelings, I guess, that usually manifest themselves in what could be described, I hear the phrase never again, and still yet here we are.
Ben, thank
you. You could talk about that a bit.
Very good. Michael Hirsch?
He precisely put into words thoughts that have been through in my mind for the couple of years I've worked on this book. It really does bother me when people somewhat automatically, sometimes self-righteously, say never again. And yet we see what's happened in Darfur. We see what's happened in Rwanda, or the Congo, what happened in Cambodia. Never again really needs to mean something. We really need to put ourselves in a position where we say we really mean it and we're going to stop it when we know it's happening and not just celebrate it once a year.
Mr. Friedenberg, do you have a thought about that?
What was that?
Do you have a thought about that, this notion of never again, this shall never happen again, and how we speak of that today?
Well, we're very selective in where we allow it to happen. Genocide seems to be all right in some places and not all right in others. We have a very unequal approach to that, and I guess it's just impractical to try and reform the whole world at once. But yes, I think it does happen in a less spectacular way now, and will probably continue to happen.
Michael Hirsch, tell us the story quickly of Clarence Brockman. You write about him at Buchenwald. We have a picture of him back at Buchenwald this month for a commemoration ceremony there. It's at our website, onpointradio.org. It's a wonderful photo of him with a camp survivor with whom he reunites. What is Clarence's story?
Clarence was a coal miner for 43 years in Pennsylvania. I met him at the reunion of the 80th Infantry Division at Carlisle Barracks. He, along with a number of other GIs, were invited back to Buchenwald. Others were invited to Mauthausen. I believe others still were invited to Dachau for the 65th anniversary. They're really treated as honored guests. I've talked to several of them who've come back. But when I saw the picture of Clarence on your website, it made me go back to the interview that I had with him. And there's one item from my notes. He talks about seeing many, many small camps that nobody knows the names of. He remembers one in particular, and he relates this story. The one that hit me most was the camp that was down in Austria. We could see it. It was down in the valley. We went down into it. I went into the office. They had all kinds of records thrown around the floor. And somebody says, "Hey, Brock, we're moving." And I said, "Okay," and I came out. That camp there, it was full of women. The fence around was nothing but barbed wire, that was all women. And they must have fed them pretty good. They weren't exactly skinny. And this one girl in the camp, she came out. I mean, her face was bloodied up, bruised. She had black eyes, everything. So we got a hold of her and asked what happened. She says, "Well, that's the German over there, SS man." The SS man was a prisoner. She says, "He tried to rape me, and I fought back. I knew the Americans were coming, so I wasn't going to let him have me, and I fought back, and he beat the heck out of me." And Clarence says, "And so one of the guys walked over and said, 'Is this the guy?'" pointing to the SS man. She says, "Yes. We shot him, just like that." The American soldiers were not very generous to SS that they captured. More often than not, they shot them.
Let's go to a call here. Suzanne is in Youngstown, New York. Suzanne, welcome to the program. I don't have much time. If you could be brief, I'm sorry.
My father was a scout in the 353rd with the 89th Division that discovered Ohrdruf, and he told me about the bodies piled high, and it pained him, I think, for his entire life. He died. We are going to Ohrdruf next week for the 65th anniversary of VE Day, and I just wondered if someone out there knew my father and remembered him. So thank you very much.
Suzanne, thank you. Michael Hirsch, I wondered if you'd finish our hour here with your interview with Leonard Lubin. He died about a year ago, but I know he was one of the more memorable of the veterans with whom you spoke. Briefly, what did you learn, and why is his experience applicable today?
Leonard Lubin was one of the people who said, "I'm not a liberator." He says most of us were draftees. Even if we weren't, we were just ordinary people like lots of people today, nothing special. People hear you're a liberator, their eyes gloss over and they speak in hushed terms. But he accepts the term eyewitness. He walked into a camp called Wells, a subcamp of Gunskirchen, and burned into his memory until the moment he died was a survivor coming out, finding a tomato can lying on the street with the top jaggedly open like you used to use those those handheld can openers, and he saw this man trying to get his whole face into the can to lick whatever sustenance might be in it. And the cover was of the can was ripping the man's face open, and the man was bleeding and desperate for one last gram of food. And Leonard Lubin told me that's a sight that to him says what the Holocaust is all about, and he never forgot it.
Michael Hirsch, many thanks for all your work, for your reporting. Thanks for sharing it with us today.
Thank you very much, Jane. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Michael Hirsch is author of The Liberators, America's Witnesses to the Holocaust. And Stanley Friedenberg, we're so grateful to you, sir, for your service to our country and for your time today.
You're certainly welcome.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.